Ever since ancient times, scholars and philosophers have posited that character, and not just smarts, is what make people succeed. Now, cutting-edge research is proving the ancients right. In his latest book, How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character, Paul Tough takes his readers on a tour of this research and into the lives of educators and others who are experimenting with new ways of inculcating these attributes in our youngsters. Paul joins us today to talk about his book, the impact he hopes it will have on the education reform debate, and what it means for the broader war on poverty. Join us for today's edition of the Education Next Book Club. Welcome back. This is your second time on our podcast. I think about a year ago, we chatted about Whatever It Takes, your book on Jeffrey Canada and the Harlem Children's Zone. Welcome back to the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So what got you interested in this new book?
Well, I think it was two things. One was finishing Whatever It Takes, finishing my reporting on Jeffrey Canada, and feeling like I still had some questions that I wanted answered, and that they felt sort of like big questions about how children succeed, why it is that some kids succeed and some kids fail, what it is in kids' circumstances that push them in one direction or another. The other thing that happened was my wife and I had our first child 3 years ago, just as I was starting work on this book. So suddenly these questions took on a kind of urgency that they hadn't had before.
And I want to start with the basics here. You say how children succeed. So for you, what do you mean by success?
Good question. I mean, to me, the definition of success that I'm using in the book and that the scholars that I'm writing about are using is not, that itself isn't that revolutionary. It is, you know, having a deep, rich, meaningful, happy life, which involves some markers of material success, things like educational attainment and salary, but I think also more kind of nuanced things like happiness and fulfillment. I think what is new about this research is about the particular skills and traits that get kids there.
Right. Now, are there certain ideas or common wisdom that you're trying to dislodge with this book? I mean, what are you arguing against in this book?
So I give a name to the thing I'm trying to argue against, which is the cognitive hypothesis. So what I define that as is just this idea that what really matters in the success of children today is their IQ, their cognitive skill, the stuff that gets measured on standardized tests. And I think that we all believe in it to some degree or another. It's sort of the thing that's behind our obsession with test scores. And I think on an individual level, people will sort of say like, oh, that stuff isn't really what's important. But I think as a culture, we really have embraced that idea. And certainly in terms of our policies, it's really what drives them.
So this is sort of the Charles Murray hypothesis that says, look, IQ is going to determine to a large degree how far people are going to be able to get, at least academically. And we should be realistic about that, not expect those kids with low IQs to go on to college, that sort of thing.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, so specifically the Real Education, I think, right, was his book, where I felt like, and I talk about that book in this book. In some ways, I think that in terms of college, at least, that is the sort of pure cognitive hypothesis, that what's going on in education, certainly in college, is just mostly sorting. It's not really about you know, pulling kids from one place and the bell curve to another.
Now, let me push on this a little bit. There is this cognitive hypothesis, which might be about IQ, which some people feel is or is not malleable. But there's something else, which, say, E.D. Hirsch would argue is more about knowledge, you know, that is very malleable, that what matters and that what we're trying to get after with many school reforms and even with testing is having kids learn more stuff. Mm-hmm. And that kids who learn more stuff end up to go on to have more power and more opportunities. Do you address that directly in the book? What's your take on that?
I don't talk about Hirsch or knowledge as a separate category in the book. And I mean, I think there's something that's definitely valid about that. I think, you know, I guess part of the problem is I think it's hard to measure that. It's hard in some ways to separate that from tests that measure intelligence. But the research that drew me more was this research about these character strengths, about non-cognitive skills.
Okay, so let's talk about that research. And you start by talking about James Heckman as being in the middle of many of these worlds of different researchers. But tell us a little bit about James.
So he is a Nobel Prize winning economist at the University of Chicago. And So he won the Nobel in 2000, and it was right about that same time that he started looking into non-cognitive skills, and it's sort of transformed his research. This is now at the center of what he does, and it's pushed him in all sorts of unusual places. You know, he's in some ways like this very advanced theoretical economics guy, but now he's into psychology and neuroscience and animal behavior and collaborating with all sorts of very different kind of scholars.
And so he has brought a community of scholars together who are looking at these questions from different perspectives.
And mostly the communities that he's trying to bring together are economics and psychology.
Okay.
That they have two different ways of talking. He thinks they have two different ways of talking about the same thing, which is personality traits and non-cognitive skills. Non-cognitive skills being the economics term, personality traits being the psychological term. But these two bodies of research are totally separate, don't interact at all, mm-hmm. have, you know, similar but different words for the same thing. And he's saying, you know, we can actually learn from each other.
Right.
There's something here.
And the argument in the book is that these are the things that do seem to really matter. Not so much IQ, but character traits like grit and perseverance and curiosity and so on and so forth. Now, you start off the book by talking, though, about poverty and about deep poverty, the huge challenges that kids in very difficult neighborhoods face. And you talk about something, it's adverse childhood experiences, which I guess is now an official scientific term. What does that mean? What's that about?
So the adverse childhood experience study is known as the ACEs study, and it was something that was done I believe it was about 20 years ago, by a couple of medical doctors, an epidemiologist and a medical doctor, working in California, who had this huge database of 17,000 patients who were all in the Kaiser HMO. And they gave each of them this pretty simple questionnaire asking them for how many of this list of adverse childhood experiences they'd had. And it was things like, you know, from having divorced parents to having an alcoholic in your home to being the victim of abuse or neglect. And so 17,000 people wrote back, and they were mostly like middle-aged, middle-class white folks who lived in Southern California. And so they found a couple things. One was that the incidence of these adverse experiences, even among this pretty middle-class population, was much higher than they expected. A lot of people had some pretty rough childhoods. But then what they were able to do, because they were an HMO, was have access to detailed medical records from all of these people. And as they tried to correlate the ACEs data with the medical data, they found this very strong correlation between the number of ACEs that a person has experienced and bad health outcomes, everything from heart disease to smoking to depression, suicide, and including, so some of them were sort of behavioral things like depression, suicide, smoking, but some of them were just physical maladies.
Mm-hmm.
And so this started people thinking about what was going on, what it was in a traumatic childhood that was having such a negative effect on children's outcomes.
And the impact on their psychology, but also in some ways on their physiology, perhaps.
Yeah, so this pushed me and pushed some of the other people who are researching in this field into this realm called neuroendocrinology, which is the interaction of the stress system, the hormone system, with the development of the brain. And it's fascinating. It's very complicated. I'm still not always sure that I understand what I'm talking about when I talk about it. But it is really fascinating research. And it's about how, especially in the first couple of years, mm-hmm. experiencing what these scientists call toxic stress, so not just mm-hmm. sort of regular stress, but really intense and chronic stress, mm-hmm. has a terrible effect on a child's developing brain, mm-hmm. In ways that you can actually measure in brain scans down the road. And so it has these physical effects. It increases, you know, your heart disease and your pulmonary disease problems down the road. It also affects cognitive functioning, especially executive functions. And it also affects mental health. It leads to depression and anxiety of all kinds.
And poor kids, especially kids growing up in deep poverty, tend to have many more of these adverse experiences than other kids do.
They do. And so the place where I saw the ACEs study in action was at this pediatric clinic in a low-income neighborhood in San Francisco, where this doctor, Nadine Burke-Harris, was trying to treat this very troubled, very low-income population, and felt like she was doing everything that was in the sort of public health playbook in terms of getting the kids their immunizations and making sure they had the right medications for every illness that came along, but felt like she wasn't actually addressing the real health problems, or the real problems at the root of their health. And that's when she stumbled upon the ACEs study, and it really gave her a whole new lens to look at her population. And when she started giving the ACE questionnaire to the families, to the kids in her practice, she found real correlations with their school problems. And so the kids who had the highest ACE scores were the ones who were getting in trouble in school, who were failing, who were running into all kinds of problems.
All right, now connect the dots for us then between this body of work and what you're looking at here and this larger issue of character and personality traits.
So, I mean, I think what I'm trying to argue in the book is that these three sets of research are all heading in the same direction. And then in lots of ways, what's keeping them separate is semantics, you know, the skills that, so to get back to the neuroscience end of things, one of the things that's really striking to me about the research is that there is this kind of antidote to those brain development problems, and it's parents. That when kids have a strong attachment relationship with a parent, they can be in a pretty chaotic environment and still do well. And the kind of skills that get measured when they when these scientists find out the kids are doing well are very similar to the same sorts of skills that these educators are trying to teach as character strengths. And they're very similar to the kind of things that Heckman's looking at as non-cognitive skills.
And things like executive function.
Exactly. There's a lot of overlap there as well. And so part of what's tough about this is that they're not exactly the same. So executive functions are not exactly the same as, you know, the character strengths that some of these schools are trying to teach. But I think there are really strong parallels and connections there. And I think that it's a detriment to each of these groups of researchers that they're not speaking the same language, because I think there are some really useful connections.
All right, well, we'll come back to this question of ACE, the adverse childhood experiences. You go on and you talk about Kip. It's almost impossible these days to have a book on these topics without Kip, but for good reason, because David Levin at the Kip Bronx, one of the original schools, and of course David, one of the founders of Kip, has become obsessed with teaching these non-cognitive skills. Or does he call them character traits?
He calls them character strengths.
Character strengths. Okay, so what is it? Why is he so obsessed with this?
Well, what Dave points out quite rightly is that he and Mike Feinberg were talking about character from day one. But I think what he would say is that at the beginning of Kip, they saw, you know, academics and character as these two sides to what they were teaching. But it was sort of unscientific, right? Like they knew the systems to help kids get better at their cognitive skills, and they got, you know, thanks to Harriet Ball and others, they got extremely good, extremely fast at teaching math and reading. And they also knew that they had to teach character, or they wanted to teach character. They knew it was part of what was going to help these kids be successful. But there was no system out there to help kids do better with these skills. And so what I write about in the book is that you know, that first class of Dave's at the Kip Academy, that in eighth grade had these incredible test scores, fifth highest in the whole city, got them on the front page of the New York Times and 60 Minutes. As those kids went through high school and especially through college, they started dropping out. And so I think something like 24% of that first class has earned a BA, which, you know, for the neighborhoods those kids were coming from was really good. But for Dave Levin's standards of what he was hoping to accomplish for Kip was not anywhere near what he wanted to accomplish. And what he found as he was talking to these kids was that what was holding them back as they got through their educational career was not that they didn't know the right stuff, and not that they weren't, you know, didn't have the math skills, or that they'd forgotten what he taught them in seventh grade. It was that they didn't have what seemed to him to be character strengths, that they would hit some sort of problem or setback, as kids always do, and especially kids who are, you know, the first kid in their family to go to college, and they just wouldn't have the resources, the inner strength to deal with it, and so they'd get derailed. And so I think that's why he's obsessed about it now. I think he he's had this instinct since the beginning, but I think he is now, in his very scientific way, trying to figure out a way to replicably teach these skills to every KIPP student.
Maybe they should call it now the Character is Power program. They could still call it KIPP.
That's true. Hard C. Yeah, exactly.
Hard C. Well, so David came across a set of researchers, including Angela Duckworth and others, who have been looking into this. And in the end, some of those researchers were able to whittle down these list of character strengths to 7, I understand. Let me read them. Grit, self-control, zest, social intelligence, gratitude, optimism, and curiosity. Why these 7? What is so important about these?
So where the 7 came from is, it's partly a story of these two researchers, Martin Seligman and Chris Peterson, who wrote this book called Character, Strengths, and Virtues. And they came up with a list of 24 that they think are the character strengths that transcend sort of culture, transcend time and place. They're important anytime through history, anywhere in the world. So the 7 were what Dave calls high leverage character strengths. And I think they were partly sort of adapted for a school setting that, you know, some of them, like love, for instance, Dave didn't think it was like the right place for a school to be talking a lot about love. But things like curiosity seemed like they were, you know, very much on an academic, part of an academic mission.
Right.
And so working with these educators, they came up with these as the big 7.
Okay, very good. Now, the next step. Dave Levin wants to be able to teach these and measure them.
Yes.
So what does he do?
So he has a character report card. And in the year that I was reporting at KIPP Infinity and some of the other KIPP schools in New York, they were just rolling out the character report card for the first time. And it's now, I think, in every KIPP school in New York. There are other KIPP schools around the country that are starting to experiment with it. But I think New York is the only place that it's fully rolled out. And so if you're a kid at KIPP Infinity, 4 times a year, every one of your teachers evaluates you on a scale of 1 to 5 on every one of these 7 character strengths. And you get a report card telling you how you've done in your curiosity and your zest and your social intelligence.
And how do you measure zest?
Well, it is... I mean, it is subjective, right? So it's the teacher. Like all grades, it's somewhat subjective.
Yeah.
And so all of your teachers are evaluating you, and they are, you know, zest is one of Dave Levin's favorites, I think, on the 7, partly because he's a very zesty guy.
He is, yes.
And I think he's right that, like, this is something that, you know, when we talk about, like, in the old version of the character report card, you know, he talks about, like, the right side of the report card. Like, zest was never measured, right? It was all about behavior and deportment and following the rules.
Right.
And the argument he makes, and I think it's a good one, is like that in actual learning and especially in like adult life, like being enthusiastic about stuff, being especially enthusiastic about learning is incredibly important. Certainly, it's important in college.
Right.
But it didn't get measured by this old kind of character report card, the, you know, behavior grade. And so he's arguing that it's important to measure. And you know, I think it's actually not that hard to measure in a kid. I mean, it's like any grade. There's a lot of subjectivity on the part of the teacher. But I think if you're a middle school teacher, you know which kids are the zestiest, you know.
Yeah.
And they're often not the most self-controlled.
Right.
And so getting a kid who's got both zest and self-control is a challenge. But I think, you know, what Dave's trying to argue is that you can get a number for each of these kids. And I mean, the thing I want to say about the character report card is that in some ways, I like the idea that they're doing it as rigorously as they are. But I do think that report card is in some ways a misnomer and kind of a red herring, because it's not... it's not a report. It's like you don't get held back a year if you're not zesty enough. You know, you can't fail your curiosity. What it really feels to me like is like a character conversation piece. So I went to the first report card night where they were handing out these character report cards. And what happens at KIPP is all the parents come in, they sit down at a table with one teacher, one kid, one parent, and I got to sit in on a couple of these conversations, and they have the character report card, and they just go through and have this conversation. about, you know, little Bobby and how he's doing on his curiosity and what he could work on more. And your teachers say you're great on this kind of self-control, but not that kind of self-control. And that just seems like an incredibly valuable conversation for parents and kids and teachers to have. And it's not one they often have. Like when those three people are sitting together and talking about, you know, anything in the character realm, it's usually because Bobby's in big trouble because he's done something terrible. The whole language is about punishment and failure and disappointment, right, and how he messed up and what's wrong with him, you know? Right. And whereas this is in the context of like, here's what's working, here's what's not working. And it's also in the context of like, this stuff can change, you know? So it's not, it is like the Carol Dweck mindset research, I think, is a big part of this as well. This idea that like, not just your intelligence is malleable, but your character. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an incredibly powerful message to give to kids who I think often feel like, and often hear the message that I just am who I am. I'm stuck with the kind of kid I am.
Right, that you can learn to become more optimistic or learn to become more zesty.
Right, and I think that's, you know, that's powerful for me as an adult.
Absolutely.
I've certainly taken it to heart. It's not easy to change those things, but I think it's possible. But I think it's really powerful for, you know, a seventh grade student, because I feel like they're at this moment where they really are malleable. We know from looking at seventh grade students that they change a whole bunch between there and adulthood, but they don't think so often. You know, they just feel like they're stuck. And I think a lot of educators and a lot of education systems encourage that. You know, encourage that message, whether consciously or not, that, you know, you are who you are. You're this kind of kid. You're that kind of kid. You're this track. You're that track.
Right. All right. So next, you take your readers into the world of competitive chess. And in particular, into IS318, which is a middle school in Brooklyn, which has a championship chess team and what sounds like an amazing chess coach, Elizabeth Spiegel. What does she do that is so effective, and what does this have to do with this issue of character?
So I started reporting on the chess team back more than 3 years ago, and I didn't know what I was going to find when I started doing that reporting. I read this one piece in the Times that this school had done amazingly, and I thought, and I think I was mostly right, that the schools that do well in chess tournaments are rich kid schools, you know, or they're exam schools, or, you know, selective schools of some form. And when you look at the who wins most chess championships, that's true. It is those schools. But not in middle school in the United States for the last few years. For the last few years, in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, it's IS318 that wins. And they were just doing it consistently, and I wanted to know why. And so I figured, yeah, they must be some kind of magnet school. They must have, like, all the smartest kids in Brooklyn. But they don't. They're just an average school. So I went and tried to figure out what she was doing and spent a few years watching her. And what I believe she is doing is in some ways it's very similar to what's happening in those character report card conversations. After each game, at a tournament or even in class, whether you win or lose, if you're an IS318 student, you go and you sit down with Ms. Spiegel and you have to play your whole game again, move by move. And so I've watched a bunch of these conversations as well, and they are grueling because she is really tough. You know, she's not like, as she puts it at one point, she doesn't hug, you know. She's not one of those teachers who's sort of saying like, oh, you know, what's important is you tried hard and you did your best and you had fun. She's like, why would you do that? I can't believe you made that move. Why would you move your rook? And she's really tough on them. And then she says, you know, well, what could you have done differently, right? She turns it into this conversation of like, and so literally, like, what could you have done differently at move 16, you know, mm-hmm. in this very precise kind of way. You know, just it's clearly very, very successful. It means a lot to the kids. What I think is going on is that they feel like someone is paying close attention to them and is really focused on them getting better. You know, there's this rule of thumb that Elizabeth actually told me about, but I think most teachers know, that you're supposed to give 5 compliments for every 1 criticism. And she's like the opposite. She's giving 5 criticisms for every 1 compliment. And she actually is worried that she was being too mean to these kids. But I think, you know, the 5 compliments idea is that what you need to build up in kids is their self-esteem, right? And what she's doing is not building up their self-esteem, but I think what she's doing is giving them something deeper, something like character, because she is showing them how to manage failure, how to deal with setbacks, and how to get better at it. And my sense is it's incredibly meaningful to these kids, not only in chess, but in life as well.
And you describe that it's a little bit like cognitive therapy. I think Buddhists would call it mindfulness.
Sure,
I mean,
sure.
You know, this idea that can the kids learn to see how they are thinking, this sort of metacognition idea.
Yeah. I mean, that so the person in the book who first said cognitive behavioral therapy to me was actually the dean at KIPP Infinity. And I think there's some people at KIPP who sort of wish he hadn't used that term. I think it is what they're doing. But I think that, understandably, like, people get anxious about right. educators using the word therapy because they think it's about, you know, making kids lie on the couch and talk about their parents, you know. But I think what is going on in those KIPP discipline conversations, for instance, is pretty similar to cognitive behavioral therapy, and that is, I think, in a way, what Elizabeth Spiegel is doing with her chess students. And cognitive behavioral therapy is really just, it's just about mindfulness, about metacognition, about thinking about your own processes. Why do I make these mistakes that I make? And I think it's incredibly effective. Certainly, it's effective for kids in those situations.
Right. So the kids have a chance to think back to the moves that they made and see that they had a choice to make a different move. Or in some cases, you write about a kid who just was impulsive, that rather than waiting and thinking about his next move, he spent 2 seconds and he made the move, and it turned out to be a big mistake. And so now he knows the next time he plays a game, he's going to work harder at slowing it down.
Yes.
And that was the message she was getting across to him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. One of the things that I like best in reporting on Elizabeth Spiegel was there was this one, she actually did have this one more sort of like, not quite a discipline conversation, but a social conversation with this one kid who was having trouble with some of his peers because he had lent them his football and taken it away and got into trouble. Yeah. And she started, it sort of only dawned on me afterward that this is what she was doing, but she started leading him through the situation in exactly the same way that she did with chess. You know, it was like, well, why did you do that? And how did they react? And what did you think they were going to do? And so there was something about watching her do that after watching her do it in chess that made me think, this is what's going on. And this is a kind of technique that works not just in chess, in lots of different situations.
So you raise a question that's very important and somewhat obvious, right? Which is that if these are the traits that matter for persistence and success, including persistence and success in college, then is our college admissions process set up the right way or not? What's your take on that?
I don't talk about college admissions all that much. I actually, more recently, I was talking to this guy, Robert Sternberg, who used to be the head of admissions at Tufts and is now at Oklahoma State. And he has some really, I think, interesting ideas about how to reform college admissions to include more of these non-cognitive skills. So I think that absolutely could be part of it. But the research that I find most interesting is that if you're focused not just on college access and like freshman GPA, but if you're focused on college persistence as a goal, you're actually going to look for a different set of skills in kids. Mm-hmm. That part of the reason that our dropout numbers right now are so high is about non-cognitive skills.
And that some research showing that it's really high school GPA that seems to be much more correlated with those kinds of skills and college success than the SAT score.
Yeah, yeah. I've mostly been writing about K-12 education before this, and I hadn't encountered a lot of this college data, but it was really striking to me. So I went and read Nick Lemon's book, The Big Test, about the development of the SAT in the years after World War II. It's a great book and a great story. And, you know, the reason that they developed the SAT was that GPA was considered not good enough, right? It was too subjective. What was a good GPA at this school might be totally different than the GPA at that school. And we had to somehow have this scientific measurement that would say which kids were going to thrive in college. But what researchers have found more recently is that relationship doesn't hold true, that SAT and ACT scores are less good predictors of college persistence than GPA. And the argument for why that's happening goes back to non-cognitive skills, that you know, what Angela Duckworth at the University of Pennsylvania has found out is that IQ and standardized test scores are very much correlated, but measures like self-control are much more correlated with GPA. And in fact, self-control is more correlated with GPA than IQ is correlated with GPA. So to me, all of this data comes together to suggest that what kids really need to graduate from college is self-control and persistence and all of these other non-cognitive skills.
Right. And now, I would argue, as long as they also have the academic preparation, that if you have one and not the other, you haven't necessarily gotten kids where they need to be.
For sure. And what I would say as well is that it's going to be easier to get them that sort of academic preparation in high school if they've got those other skills.
Now, on one hand, this is an optimistic message, and it sounds like, okay, well, this is great. What we need to do is have schools follow KIPP's lead and other schools that are out there doing innovative things and do a better job teaching these character strengths. On the other hand, the book ends with a somewhat somber note, which goes back to the deep poverty and these kids that are experiencing these very traumatic childhoods, where you say that basically what it has to come down to there is having a caring parent. And we're not sure how to make that happen. Say a little bit about that.
Sure. I mean, I would characterize it slightly differently than you.
Okay,
I mean, I absolutely feel like having a caring parent is probably the best thing that can happen in a kid's life. There's nothing else in terms of contributing to success. I don't think statistically there's anything else that's as positive. But I absolutely don't think that for kids who don't have a caring parent, there's nothing we can do for them. I think lots of these interventions actually compensate for a lack of that sort of parental support and attachment early on. I think two things. One is I think that we can do more to help parents do better. And some of the interventions that I write about in the book are parenting interventions with some of them with especially troubled parents, helping them learn attachment-producing behaviors. There's some amazing results. I mean, these are still mostly pretty experimental programs, but there are some amazing results about how working with parents on some of these attachment behaviors changes like the neurological functioning of their kids. This is an intervention that doesn't work with the kids at all, but you can actually measure changes in stress hormones in the kids simply by their parents going to these interventions. So again, pretty experimental. We'll see how it works down the road. We'll see if we put money behind it, but it seems like a really potentially very powerful intervention. But even if that doesn't happen, I think that a lot of the interventions that are going on in adolescence can absolutely compensate for those. And so I did a lot of reporting on the south side of Chicago with a couple of different interventions, one called One Goal and one called YAP, working with slightly different populations. But in both cases, using somewhat different methods, they were intervening with kids who had really, really tough early childhoods or childhoods in general, but they were having these really transformative experiences in adolescence because of connections that they were forming with teachers and particular types of training in what I would call, anyway, non-cognitive skills. And these kids were doing much better than they would have otherwise. So the girl that I spent the most time with in the book, this young woman now named Kiwana Lerma, she grew up in really rough situation, homeless a lot of the time, single mother who was not always ready to be a mother. And Kiwana was in the slow class in sixth grade had 72 referrals, discipline referrals in her sixth grade year. And she got in this, it was partly, I think, her own transformation. I think she came with some of these character strengths, but it was partly going through this program, One Goal, that helped her work on these non-cognitive skills in her junior and senior year of high school. And she's now entering her sophomore year in college, and she got 4 A's and a B last year at Western Illinois University. So in other words, I'm saying all this just to say I absolutely don't think that the message of the book is that you got to do parenting or if you don't have the right parents, you can't succeed. I think it's tougher, and it's a reason why I think we should be thinking more about how to help families and not just wait until school to intervene. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like the message is, even for those kids where we didn't start early enough, we didn't work with their families, there's mm-hmm. things we can do later on.
And yet, are you hopeful that, as you said a minute ago, the money is going to be there? We don't hear a lot of talk about these kinds of anti-poverty interventions anymore.
We don't. I mean, I think, like, to me, it goes back to the current state of education politics, and it's part of why I'm trying to show and create these connections between these different fields. I feel like these researchers are doing exactly what Arne Duncan is trying to do, and improve kids' lives in exactly the same way, but it's not education, officially, and so it's not considered part of the same project. But it should be, right? Mm-hmm. I think that if the project becomes how do you help kids in a place like the South Side of Chicago do better, then the answer is schools is a huge part of it, but so are these other four things, including mm-hmm. working with their parents, helping them in their families. and giving them these sorts of other programs in or out of school as adolescents that are going to help them develop these skills. But the way that we divide up our government aid, those spheres don't interact at all. Mm. And I think that's a huge problem. And it means that there is no one part of government or society or anywhere that's really asking this question of, like, a kid is born on the south side of Chicago, what are we as the public going to do to try to help them have a successful life? Right now, what we do, you know, the argument we have is, it's going to happen in schools, so we can fight about what kind of school they should have in order to help them. What I feel like this research says is that, yeah, we should be paying very close attention to their school, but they also need more. And so how do we coordinate help for those kids in a way that's going to give them a much more positive path through childhood and life?
You write in the book that you yourself were a college dropout, and that more recently you dropped out of the New York Times in order to write this book. What's next? Do you have another book project that you're starting to think about?
I don't. I got to the end of this one and felt like, yeah, I needed to take a little time to rethink things before I know what question I'm going to ask next. But I'm sure in the next few months, one will start to occur to me.
All right. Well, again, this is Paul Tough, the author of How Children Succeed, Grit, Curiosity, and the Hidden Power of Character. Paul, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kansterum. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy. And I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.